We've got a special guest with us today, delighted to be joined by Neil Dring. Now, Neil is a senior solicitor and consultant for Jones Myers at the Harrogate office. Now, Jones Myers are a multiple award-winning family law firm. Of the year, they've been ranked number one in Yorkshire and are renowned nationally and internationally for their children's department. And Neil, we're really grateful for your time and your expertise. Just tell us why you guys wanted to do the podcast with us.
Yeah, well, I think divorce is a difficult area for people to deal with. A lot of people don't necessarily understand the ins and outs of divorce law. And I just wanted to shed some light on what we as lawyers do, what the different areas that we need to cover off, things that we need to think about, and how we as divorce lawyers can help people. And in particular, I wanted to stress how lawyers within the divorce and financial settlement field are not all about going to court, but our focus is in trying to keep people out of court and coming to fair settlements out of court, because we're dealing with families here. Families often with children who will continue to be families even after they're separated, even after they divorce. And so we need to do everything that we possibly can to make that life for them better for the future. I just wanted to explain to people how we do that.
And we're going to cover all sorts of things, aren't we, over the next sort of 20 minutes or so. Give us a bit of a rundown of what we'll talk through.
Quite simply, really, I'm going to just discuss the various different ways of trying to sort out financial difficulties between couples on separation. In particular, focus on pensions, which is often a much ignored issue. Go through different ways of resolving cases, but with a focus on mediation, because that's probably my favourite way and the best way for families to try and resolve these issues if they can. And then also just to take you through briefly what people can expect when we meet for the first time.
Okay, so just tell us a bit about what you do at Jones Myers.
So I joined Jones Myers in September of last year. I've been a lawyer in Harrogate for the past 12 years. I principally deal with divorces and help people sort out their financial settlements within divorces. I'm heading up the Harrogate office, but I help people sort out their divorces, I help people sort out their financial settlements in a fair way, and hopefully in a non-confrontational way, so we can avoid going to court.
Okay, so starting on financial differences and how they're resolved, just give us a bit of an introduction to when a couple are separating, what needs to be sorted out.
Right, so there are lots of ways of doing it, but first of all, what needs to be sorted out? Well, usually there'll be a house. Now, it might be rented, might be owned, but you'll need to sort out what's going to happen with the house. If it's rented, who's going to continue living there? Who will give up the rights to the tenancy? If it's owned, whether it will be kept by one of the parties of the marriage, whether it will be transferred to their sole name, whether it will be sold, whether the money will be divided. And if one party ends up not having the property or losing their share of it, what will happen to their share? Will they get a lump sum later on? Or will it be transferred entirely to the one in return for them keeping other assets? There may be savings. How can we divide up the savings between the two of them? Other assets, investments, pensions, business assets, all that stuff that we have together when we're married, all the stuff that we build up together over the course of a long marriage, we need to sort out how best they can be divided fairly.
And everything has to be on the table there. You can't withhold some assets and say that won't include.
No. Well, the simple answer to that is no. The more complex answer to that is it depends. But in the first place, you must bring everything to the table. It doesn't matter what it is. You can't say, well, I didn't think that would be relevant because whatever. You must bring it all to the table. You must make full disclosure of all of your financial circumstances. Now, it's possible in some marriages, for example, where a couple may have been married late in life. It might have been their second marriage. They might have been married late in life, only a short period of time. They might have owned properties and assets and shares and investments before they were married in their respective sole names. Now, those will not necessarily be divided equally between the two. But if we start from the simple premise of a couple who've been married for a long time, have built up their house together, built up their savings and their pensions together, then you must bring all those to the table, or we must work out the fairest way of dividing it between the two of them.
And are there repercussions for people who don't give full details of their finances then?
Yeah, and they can be really significant and really important at lots of different levels. First of all, if you're not making full disclosure and your spouse and their lawyer recognise or realises that that's the case, then you lose trust. And that means that the likelihood of coming to a negotiated settlement is diminished considerably because people won't trust you, so they're not going to agree a settlement. It's far more likely, therefore, that you'll end up going to court. Secondly, actually in court itself, if it's discovered that you failed to make disclosure, then within the court process, you lose credibility with the judge, so that if there's any doubt about other things later on, the judge is likely to decide against you because they know that you didn't give full disclosure earlier on. It can also be taken into account, very briefly, the court can take into account what they call litigation misconduct when deciding what orders to make, which means you can be penalised in the eventual order. You can have orders for costs made against you as well. So there's lots of different reasons why you could lose out in the longer term by failing to disclose. But also, critically, whenever an agreement is reached, it's vitally important that that agreement is tied up in what we call a consent order. So it's made into a legally binding court order as a full and final settlement and a clean break, which means that neither one of you can come back and claim more against the other in the future. If that is done, that's great. No further claims can be brought. But if that clean break order is made and it's later discovered that you failed to disclose some substantial financial circumstances or assets, then that legally binding agreement can be set aside. So all that hard work can be undone, and that would mean that your former partner could bring further claims in the future. So the byword is, for goodness sake, make full disclosure at the outset, because if you don't, you could be moving into a lot of trouble in the future.
And that brings us on to pensions. And this is one where sometimes people might not realise going into this process that actually it is very, very important in a financial settlement to be aware of what will happen to you. Retirement may seem like a lifetime away.
Yes, absolutely. And it's becoming more and more important. I was amazed. A few weeks ago, I saw some research that had been done by an organisation to say that in 60% of all divorce cases, pensions aren't even considered, which just blew me away. I thought that's just not possible. As lawyers, we will always look at pensions and consider whether it's appropriate to take them into account. It's becoming more and more important to do that because over the last 15, 20 years, pensions are becoming more and more important parts of our lives. The law about pensions came in 20 years ago. Before then, pensions really weren't considered at all in settlements, but now they are front and centre. The pension can be sometimes certainly the second biggest asset that a couple have together, sometimes the biggest. There can be huge pension pots. And you've got to consider whether you want to take a share of a pension for your future pension later in life. For example, you might have a couple where one might have stopped working or might have gone to part-time working when the children were born, and the other party continued in employment and has paid large sums into pensions. We know recently the government is just bringing new rules that allows the pension pots to be increased. There's no limit on what you can put into your pension now. The plan would have been, when we retire, we'll live off that one pension. On divorce, that's no longer the case. So you've got to take into account that pension and how the one without the pension is going to be compensated for that. Loads of ways of doing that. One simple way, is to look at the pension pot that one has got and make what we call a pension sharing order. Takes money out of one pension pot, sticks it in another pension in the other person's name, so they've now got their own pension for their future set aside there. Two separate pensions by a transfer from one to the other. On the other hand, what we can also do is what's called an offsetting arrangement. So if one wants to stay in the house, which might be worth a substantial amount of money, the other one has got a large pension, but for whatever reason isn't too bothered about the house, You could say, well, tell you what, one then stays in the house, keeps the house, the other one keeps their pension, and we offset the claims that they each have against those against each other. You've got to be careful there. You've got to look at the valuations. You've got to make sure that the values are right, because you've got to make sure that the amount of the value of the house that one is transferring is equivalent to the value of the pension that the other is transferring. It might be, for example, that the right result would be for one to stay in the house and have a reduced pension share rather than no pension whatsoever. And that's where you've got to be careful to look at the pension values, make sure that you look at the details of the pension and work out what the right amount of transfer is.
I think it's really good to get this on people's radars now and talk about this, because I can see where it might get overlooked because retirement seems far off, or it's very different to something like a house that you can make a phone call, have valued, and you know that immediately. But you'll have a lot of people who are directors of companies who potentially put a lot of money, a lot of their earnings into
absolutely.
Their pension.
Absolutely. You can have huge pension schemes. And I think one of the main reasons why it might be ignored, well, I suppose there's two, but one is just a lack of understanding. The individual without the pension might not really know or understand what the pension value could potentially be or what they might be losing. And also their immediate worries are, I just want to stay in the house. And they're not thinking ahead. They're not thinking about the next 5, 10, 15 or 20 years. They're thinking about tomorrow, next week, next year. And there are sometimes situations where people only look to the short-term fix, and I'm just desperate to stay in the house, so I'm happy to do that, provided, and I'm happy not, therefore, to have a pension claim. We've got to just make sure that they take a step back. Not for me to tell people what to do. If that's ultimately what they end up wanting to do, that's for them to sort out. But I just need to make sure that we take a step back and think about it slowly and carefully and plan for the future and say, OK, so if we do that, what are you going to do in 20 years' time when you do retire? How are you going to live? How are you going to pay for the house that you're going to be living in then, because you're not going to have the pension income to do it? So it's not my job to tell people how to live their lives and how to plan for the future, but it's my job to make sure that they take everything into account and they know what potentially those problems might be in the future.
When I met you, Neil, you said to me for the first time, you said, my favourite bit about my job is the first meeting. And tell us a bit about that first meeting.
That's something I've always enjoyed, because I think it's great to be able to shine a light on people's worries and concerns, because they're in a situation where they're frightened very often. They're scared about what might happen for the future. They have absolutely no knowledge of what the future might hold for them. They don't know what their options are, and they don't know whether there will be a future. And my role is just to sit them down and go through it and find out about their circumstances, find out about what they're worried about, what they're concerned about, what their fears are, what wakes them up in the morning, when they wake up, what's the first thing they think about, and what their priorities are. And then to give them options about what we can do, what the law allows, what the law provides for, what rights they might have, what's going to be taken into account, and what the different options are that they've got for themselves and what that might mean for their futures, and how we can get through this. And, you know, it's a dreadful time to go through. It's one of the low points in people's lives. But there is a future beyond it, and my job is to show them what that future might be and how they can achieve that future, and what the different options are, because there's never one answer. There's always lots of different ways, lots of different paths to go down. So I've got to just explain to people what those different paths might be and then let them choose the route that they want to go down, and take them on that journey, as it were. And the great thing is when people will come into those first interviews, either or sometimes on the phone, because people will ring and they'll want to speak straight away. Sometimes people will ring in the lunch break, they just want to make an appointment and get off the phone, and they'll come in a week later. And at the start of it, people will be very concerned and worried and won't have a clue about what the future holds for them. The end of that, half an hour, 40 minutes, hour, however long it takes, it doesn't matter. You can just see the weight lifting off their shoulders, and occasionally a little smile, because I think, okay, we can do this, we can get through this together.
So expect to be asked a lot of questions that you may have never been asked before, I guess.
Well, kind of, but I mean, I've got to say my approach is not to ask too many questions to begin with, but it's just to put my pen down, not take notes, and let people talk. Because I think if you relax and you let people talk, they'll tell you what they're thinking, they'll tell you what they're feeling, and they'll tell you what they want to tell you, rather than me find out what I think I should know, because how do I know what's in their minds? How do I know what their concerns are? So my first approach is just to have an open door and just let people talk and tell me what they're worried about and tell me what they want to tell me. And sometimes that can go on for a long time. That's fine. They need to get it off their chests. And then if there's other stuff that I then need to know that they haven't told me in that process, then I will ask some questions just to add to that stock of knowledge. It will normally be about the amount of the mortgage or the value of the house and, you know, stuff like that. So it's always useful to have that basic information. But even so, at a first appointment, the first meeting, people often won't know what the house is worth. They might not even know what their mortgage is, oddly, because they just haven't got that information. They might not know what their partner's got in savings or what pensions are worth, or even sometimes, oddly enough, they don't even know what their partner might be earning. But that doesn't matter too much, because we can still give a broad indication of the sort of approach that we can take. But obviously, the more financial information you've got, the better. I don't advocate people coming in with a lever arch file of bank statements and payslips. We don't need to go into that kind of detail. But you know, you'll be asked information broadly about what your general financial situation is, but more importantly, about what you want to achieve, about what your aims are, what your concerns are, and what you want to do. And then we can see whether we can do that, because I believe in trying to achieve what you want to achieve rather than me telling you what I think should happen. Because ultimately, it's not for me to tell you what should happen. I tell you the options, and then you decide which way we go.
Can you tell us a bit about mediation and where that comes in and how quickly you would be talking about mediation with somebody?
Well, mediation, we've always been huge advocates of mediation. And when mediation was introduced back in the 90s, I was actually on one of the first training courses to become a mediator. So we really promote mediation as a way of resolving things. When you think about it, if we ever have a problem, and we're talking about a couple who are separating, they have a problem wanting to know how they're going to sort out the house and the pensions and the savings and so on. Whenever we have any problem within our lives, the first thing that we normally do is we discuss it with the person that we're having the disagreement with. We find out what they feel, we tell them what we think, and then we try to find a common ground where we can reach an agreement and a middle line and a compromise, and we move on from there. And we do that all the time. We do it at home with the kids over breakfast in the morning before they go off to school. We do it at the shops. We do it at work. So we do the same thing with our partners and our former partners when we separate. We have a discussion. We try and agree what we want to achieve and the way forward. The problem is that on a marriage breakdown, there's other stuff gets in the way as well. There's a lot of emotion of all kinds of things that make those discussions a little more difficult than they would otherwise be with, you know, an individual that we're not related to and that we're getting divorced from. So those discussions can be quite traumatic and they can be quite emotional. Mediation is a way of bringing two people together to have those discussions with somebody else being present as a separate, independent mediator. What we do is we go into a room, we sit down, we sit around a table, and the mediator helps and facilitates that discussion. They don't tell people what to do. They don't take sides, and they don't give advice. They're simply there to help conduct the discussions and move it forward. If the discussion gets heated, they will allow that to happen. Sometimes we need to get stuff off our chest. They'll allow that to happen, and then they bring people back to the focus again and move the conversation on forwards. If people go off at a tangent to discuss things that are not really relevant, again, sometimes they'll allow that to happen briefly, but then bring it back and focus on what we're trying to achieve. And we're always trying to move the conversation forward in a constructive way to help people come to their own agreements about what's going to happen in the future. As I say, the big takeaways are that they don't take sides. They are there to act independently to help the two people come to their own agreements. They don't give any legal advice. They expect people to take legal advice about where they stand outside of the mediation and come to the mediation armed with that advice. As a firm, we do mediations, but we also, and I particularly, help people and give the legal advice and support with the mediation. So we do both sides of that. So they don't take sides, they don't give advice, and they don't tell people what to do. The idea is that those two individuals must come to their own conclusions and agreements with the help of the mediator. If after three or four meetings that can't be done, the mediator doesn't have the casting vote. They don't say, OK, you failed to come to an agreement, this is what you're going to do. That's not what happens. If mediation fails, well, then there's no agreement reached and you go back to your respective lawyers. But in an ideal world, and mostly it happens...
And if successful, you don't have to go to court.
You don't go to court. And that's the beauty of it, because going to court can take months and months and months. It can be very traumatic, it can be very difficult, it can be very expensive. But it's also risky because you don't know which way it's going to go and you lose control over the outcome.
And you mean by that, you would just get told the decision?
A judge. I mean, let's face it, they do it properly. You know, they look into all of the evidence and they come to an outcome that they think is the right outcome. But they impose an outcome on you and on me. So they tell the people what is going to happen. And that might not be what either of the parties really wants. In fact, often it won't be. Often it's going to be somewhere between the two. So both will be equally dissatisfied with the outcome. Within mediation, you have control of what happens because you come to an agreement. So by definition, you've agreed it. So you're going to be either reasonably happy with it or at least satisfied with the outcome. So you control that outcome rather than lose control altogether and give that instead to a judge who will only make a decision many, many months down the line and probably after a lot more money has been spent achieving it. So mediation is far, far better than going to court.
And the final thing I wanted to ask you while we've got you today, Neil, was about parents specifically who are divorcing and how with children and sort of how to make sure kids aren't basically caught up in the crossfire of all of that.
Yeah, it's very difficult. Because, again, emotions, sadly, will often get in the way. But the important thing to bear in mind is that when you're dealing with issues surrounding the children are the most important thing. Never mind what you as parents might want or what you would ideally like to happen. It's all to do with what are the needs of the children. Their welfare is the paramount concern. That is the only thing the court will take into account if there's a dispute. But please, please, please avoid disputes if you possibly can, because it's far better for the children if you as parents can get your heads together and come to an agreement about who they might live with, how much time they might spend with each parent, might live with both of you for different amounts of time on different days, and how to share your parenting with the children. If you can do that, then the children will benefit, because the alternative is having to go to court. A court welfare officer, who's a kind of social worker, will get involved in the process as well and may look to ask the children about what their thoughts are, what their feelings are. But the children are then becoming embroiled and caught up in court proceedings, which we really don't want them to do if we can avoid that. So the watchword is, as parents, please do what you can to come to an agreement. By all means, take legal advice. Again, Jones Myers, we've got a separate department that deals exclusively with children's cases because they are, you know, they're very, very important, sometimes be quite complicated. Take legal advice from your lawyers about what should happen in your particular circumstances, but at all costs, for the sake of the children, please try and avoid going to court.
Well, thank you. I feel like we've covered loads in there, Neil. It's been really interesting, and I think there's a bit of, as ever, devil in the detail, really, isn't it? And there's certainly things that people won't necessarily have considered until they've been in a position to hear the podcast.
Well, that's right. And I mean, I think the important thing to bear in mind, and I've always said this, is that every individual, every single separation, every single divorce is different from another. So if you have a friend or somebody at work or a relative who's been through a divorce, by all means talk to them for support and emotional advice and so on. But please don't get your legal advice from them, because every individual is different, every situation is different, and two people in very similar factual circumstances could end up with completely different outcomes because of one tiny little thing that's different, or even just because what they want to achieve, what their aims and goals might be, are different from somebody else. So it's always my thought is always to treat people as individuals and to give very bespoke advice to that particular individual, having spoken to them for a long time and found out what their concerns are, what their needs are, what their goals are, rather than having an off-the-peg solution. Because, as I say, there's no single answer. The devil really very much is in the detail.
And if anybody would like to find out more or make that phone call, they should just give the office a ring and speak to you guys.
Yes, my mobile number's on there, my direct email address is on there. Just ring that number, you'll get straight through to me. As I say, we can either arrange a meeting whenever you want to, or if you want to go straight into it and have a conversation straight away, I'll be there to do that.